When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You can talk about film with a philosopher's zeal, or measure them all by box office appeal, but for once in your life,
be real!
Welcome one and all to a movie reviewing, reappraising, genre hopping podcast on the Playlist Podcast Network. This is Be Real from Portland. I am Chance Solem Pfeiffer, and three people today joining from the unlikeliest place, considering we watched a movie about New England hauntings. Noah Ballard, what's going on over there?
What's up, buddy? We're in Wilmington, Vermont. Lucy, my girlfriend, and our mutual friend Bree. We've taken a few days away from the city, and we've gone on hikes, cooked a lot of food, and of course we watched three movies of a similar genre.
Lucy and Bree, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having us.
Yes, thank you.
And thanks for watching these movies. You guys encounter any forest sprites and or New England demons? What's going on over there?
We were close to some demons today, I will say, for sure, on our hike today.
Nice.
Yep.
The non-maskers.
Yep.
Oh, I see. That's well done. Experts. Noah, what's our genre today?
We're going to be talking about the Halloween fare of one Tim Curry. This is a very Tim Curry Halloween episode, featuring, of course, Rocky Horror Picture Show. The somewhat little seen and worthy of a reappraisal legend, and then the It original TV movie.
I want to know how this lineup of films jibed or didn't with your cabin weekend.
Well, I tried to do movies about throuples in cabins, and that just didn't take, so
Lucy likes to come up with genres that don't actually require any movies as inspirations for them. She just likes to think of, you know, genres that should be.
Just trying to be obscure.
Mm. But that is the next innovation of our show, which is start thinking of situations that no movies fit.
Okay, moving on.
But did you have fun watching these in a cabin? Did it feel right or weird?
Felt cozy. I think it felt cozy. Felt good. I think I probably enjoyed it more since I was in a cabin.
I have to tell you, I haven't watched this many movies back to back in a long time, and I'm at the end.
Yeah. Oh, it'll warp your brain. And one of them is basically two movies.
Definitely. Yeah,
definitely felt that way.
But we broke that one up and had some food in between, which is a definitely necessary thing. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That's allowed. We're going to start with Rocky Horror Picture Show, 1975.
That's great.
All right.
Rocky Horror Picture Show, made in the year 1975, follows a newly engaged couple who have a breakdown in an isolated area and must seek shelter at the bizarre residence of Dr. Frankenfurter.
You've seen all kinds of movies, but you've never seen anything like the Rocky Horror Picture Show. Rocky Horror Picture Show is wonderfully weird.
I'm your new commander. You now are my prisoner.
They're probably foreigners with ways different than our own.
It's fabulously freaky. It's a trip to transsexual Transylvania.
I'm just a sweet transvestite.
The Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Come transsexual.
The story is strange.
What is everyone's experience with Rocky Horror Picture Show. Midnight screenings, live performances. Where are you guys at with this one?
We hadn't seen it.
This was my first time.
Mine
too. Very into it.
Yeah. None of you had seen it before. That's interesting. No. I had seen it at least three other times, like in midnight release type settings.
How long ago was your last viewing?
I think it must have been either late college or late high school, early college. I remember seeing a screening with some friends that was like set up in the backyard of this mutual friend from high school, which was like a pretty cool vibe.
Aren't people supposed to be dressed up and like singing, dancing, like in the crowd, right? That's the whole gimmick.
Yeah, and there's like props that this person had prepared for us to like interact with the scene. Like when they say toast, you're supposed to throw toast at the screen, for example.
Okay.
That's fun. We didn't do that.
No, we did not. That sounds like a better...
We did not do that. I did dispose of some honey wheat bread, though, I think, during the intermission. So that kind of counts, right?
Yeah, this is 45 years old this year. And considering it started as a stage musical, yeah, there always has been that sort of social phenomenon to it. That live element, even when you're just watching the cult movie. Noah, how did it strike you? Not away from midnight fanfare.
Well, it's interesting because like in a midnight, like just as you're saying, in a midnight screening like that, you're really not paying attention as much to the movie as to like the situation you're in. So this one, I was finally like, oh, I'm gonna actually like interact with the plot of this movie and like really try to follow it. And I've got to tell you, it's probably best to have some socializing going on, like
incorrect,
as this movie
yeah,
unfolds.
Yeah. And I'm not sure plot is the point.
No.
Is Tim Curry pretty much the point?
Oh, yes. He's definitely the point of at least this one. This movie takes a second to pick up, and then like when it does, it's like rolling. But I think his entrance, the iconic elevator down into the ballroom, is unbelievable and like one of the best entrances of an iconic character in cinema.
Did you know that originally they like really pushed to have the movie in black and white, and then it would like turn to color when that scene happened? But it
like Wizard of Oz style.
Yeah.
Wow, what an interesting idea.
It didn't happen though.
No.
Huh.
Well, it's got the lips in the beginning is like very sort of iconic in a lot of ways because that's always ends up on the poster and how the title itself is often stylized. But I just love how they're playing with color early on and like the difference between dark and light. So I think it would make sense to see that beginning in black and white. Cause it's almost like, I mean, the movie goes out of its way to be an old black and white movie at the beginning.
Right. It's making all of these references to horror and sci-fi movies of the 40s and 50s and sort of like shamelessly so, like messily so, of just like, it's a vampire movie. No, it's a Frankenstein movie. No, it's an alien movie. It changes four different times.
Yes.
So
wait, Chance, what was the experience that you watched this one?
On
your laptop during midday?
I watched it last
night. Was your
dog
there?
She was. I watched it last night, you know, stone cold sober, not probably the appropriate way to go about it. I was sort of like critiquing the audio mix. I was like, Susan Sarandon's like falsetto is not working in this. And then Tim Curry showed up and I forgot all about my
Exactly.
Right. That's the point.
Can I run something by you guys? Is every single one of these movies at its best when he's on screen? Is that putting the cart ahead of the horse too much?
No, that's right. That's the only thing that these movies have. Okay, maybe it has like a little bit. Okay, it has a little bit more, but like the most enjoyable moments.
The movie really kicks into psychosexual gear once he arrives on screen and, you know, sings about being a transsexual Transylvanian.
For this being his first film role, I mean, he played Frankenfurter on stage for a couple years before this. I feel like the thing that's really amazing is he can go really big. There is the show-stopping, wild, campy element, but he's also like so close-up ready. Like there are a lot of very confident small gestures to Frankenfurter that also blow everyone else off the screen. Like when you think he's going to go like overly performative with something raunchy and he kind of underplays like a good way to release tension. And he just like the small corners of his mouth, like it's really cool because stage actors can't always work a camera like that.
He also has those excellent moments too in one of the movies, like sort of raunchier moments when he's sleeping with both Barry Bostwick and Susan Sarandon. And it's kind of like, who's acting where and who's in the shadow and when is it Tim Curry and when is it the other actor or is it merely Tim Curry the whole time? Like, it's pretty interesting how he just uses his physical being as a shape to act.
Mm-hmm.
Guys, how did this scene make you feel? Both, like, those two instances?
Loved it.
Like, were you like, okay, can you, why?
Because having never seen the movie, I was like, how is the obvious sort of like juxtaposition of, you know, Rockwellian button up like weirdos who like something is off in their relationship. How are they going to be confronted with sort of like the uproarious like queer circus of this castle? And by the time Frankenfurter just sort of like seduces both of them with exactly the same words and exactly the same moves, I felt like, okay, here we go, now we're in it.
It has a funny read too on like how power works in those kind of dynamics in a way that I thought was pretty sound by like a 2020 standard of like how power works, but also consent works. Cause he, like you said, he uses this stock dialogue with them to get in their pants. And of course they push back at first because they have these norms that they're attached to. But then of course that it quickly gives way to interest and you never feel like he's preying on them. He's just sort of like putting that little key in the lock.
He's like Thanos. Well, that's why he's inevitable.
No, I had a similar read on this, and that's why I asked, because at first, like, when he seduces Susan Sarandon, I'm like, she is saying no. And then I'm like, okay, through a 2020 lens, like, this does not, what is the word? It doesn't.
Up to snuff?
Whatever.
Above board?
It doesn't age well. That was my initial reaction, like a second in. But then I was like, no, I'm very into this. Like, the consent is there. I feel good about this. And I was like, yeah, he probably could have seduced me.
Tim Curry in that little leather outfit could have.
Absolutely. In his corset.
Take some notes.
Yeah, I mean, because there is something about that. I mean, I made the inevitable joke, but when they're both like, it's you! And he just goes, I'm afraid so, darling. It's just like, he's afraid so, and this is what's going to happen. People will submit. Let's talk about the music. Favorite songs?
I didn't remember how much I liked Meatloaf in this movie. When he just like bursts through the cold storage and starts singing, Sweet Rock and Roll?
Mm-hmm.
What's the song?
I think that's right.
That was just such a, like a fabulous, I don't know, because his part still doesn't make a ton of sense to me, but it definitely cuts the movie in a way that's like, hey, you think these people are strange from this first 15, 20 minutes here. Look at your own Americana and like how weird that is too. And it's not that much different than the kind of thing we're showing you here, sort of dressed up and brightly lit.
That's a good point. Lucy Brie, the music?
Lucy likes the Time Warp.
No, Time Warp only is my favorite because Noah like broke out and danced in the middle of the street the other day, like talking about
this. We were walking to get coffee. Yeah. And I got that song stuck in my head for whatever reason. And I took a jump to the left, you know.
It was the hip thrust that got me.
Nice. It was, yeah, there was the pelvic thrust that made it unforgivable.
Sure.
That was when I was driven insane.
What do we think of the non-Curry elements? I felt like Richard O'Brien, who wrote the movie and plays Riff Raff, the hunchbacked handyman.
Alien.
His presence down the stretch is maybe like a little conspicuous. Like the end of this movie is like really about Riff Raff and Magenta in a way that like, that's not the appeal of Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Right. If I do have any critique of the movie, it is that it certainly doesn't land as comically as it took off. And I think when it pivots into that third sci-fi act, I was less engaged. Because there's also not a ton of music like after that big number in the swimming pool.
Right, yeah.
Like the climax itself is not a musical number.
Did you guys feel like
It's the stun gun.
Right.
Lucy, you can back me up here, but as I'm always saying in the podcast, setting is so important for me, and this is a house movie. We love a house movie. Exactly. So I think it was a thing, too, that, I mean, these movies, a lot of them do have some sort of, like, house element to them. But like the best kind of Halloween horror camp stuff, like usually takes place in a place that used to be something better.
And that you can't get out of.
And now has a Medusa machine.
Wait, can I tell you one other fun fact?
Of course.
Originally. Okay. So they cast the actor. Well, they cast Rocky, who was just a model, and they originally were going to have him like have lines, but when they heard him speak and he was like such a horrible actor, they just like cut his speaking parts, which is pretty funny.
Peter Hinwood, he's just a slab of meat.
Yes.
All of his singing is clearly dubbed over too. I mean, I think everybody like redid their singing in this, but like for him, it's not the same person, and it's pretty clear.
When he's D-Medusa'd, like his lips like aren't even saying words.
I like that you can do the, you know, Medusa lightning machine on one hand, but then my favorite production design moment of the movie is where Frankenfurter rips the tablecloth off the table and you just have there you realize they're eating on Eddie's corpse.
That was jarring.
That's a very the movie's not afraid to be gross,
right.
Which is where I think it gets some of its fun from. I mean, reading a little bit about the production, it seemed like it was fun and memorable, but also like a bit of a nightmare with like a lot of people getting sick and like the water not functioning really and no heat in a lot of the rooms. And they're like in the middle of nowhere in England, you know, so it's
clammy castle and leather shorts.
No. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So
it's fun.
It's dirty fun. And I feel like the fun of making it is clearly like in the spirit of it. How it plays out.
Let's tell people how we rate movies on Be Real, and we'll come back and everybody shall rate Rocky Horror. On Be Real, we rate movies in two categories, a good or bad for technical quality and a good or bad for watchability. So what are the four possible ratings?
I don't care!
Good movies are both well-made and highly entertaining. The Fugitive, Parasite, Rear Window, or The Hunt for Red October.
Once more, we play our dangerous game.
Good bad movies are often impressive technically, but also tough sits. Historical melodramas like The Mission, horror movies too scary or gross to rewatch, or self-serious musicals like Yentl.
Papa, can you hear me?
Conversely, bad good movies are highly flawed but still gratifying. Nonsensical hangouts like Hot Tub Time Machine or ludicrously fun action fare like Twister or Stargate.
Give my regards to King Tut, asshole.
Bad, bad movies are neither well-made nor entertaining. Examples we've covered, unfortunately, include Garden State, 50 Shades of Grey, and Attack of the Clones.
I'm deeply sorry, Master.
Got all that? Time for a rating. This seems like a classic and canonical bad good. When I'm fine sticking with that. I think the thing that keeps it on track in an intelligently campy way is you also, for me, you never feel like the musical numbers are anything more than a mad person like entertaining themselves with their friends. Like they never get like more out of hand than they seem to just be at the whim of Frankenfurter. And again, I just think like Tim Curry mugging the camera is unbelievable. There's lots of moments where I think he goes for like Cersei Lannister understatement, which I like greatly appreciated. Bad good, and Tim Curry is, as everybody knows, fantastic in this.
Yeah, I think I agree with you wholeheartedly that it's a bad good. I think it's a movie that I don't mind returning to frequently, you know, this time of year. And it is one of these iconic genre-defining performances from a fine actor doing something strange, like Tim Curry is here. So yeah, bad good.
Can I ask, like, in this instance, like, what would have needed to happen to make it a good good? Just for, like, some 1975 context.
Sure.
Of, like, a good.
I think eight different actors, a different audio mix.
okay.
Song sung more clearly, a different ending.
Yeah, I think if the story itself had been as good as, like, the fun on screen that you can remember and tell you what it was about, I think it'd be
God, the criminologist interludes add nothing for me.
That's fair.
Yeah, the criminologist is a pretty lazy move, I would say.
Sometimes you'll talk especially to him for, like, 2 minutes, and then they'll just cut right back to where they were. Like, that explanation wasn't needed.
Right, he'll just explain things that are explained over the top in the next scene. It is funny that it's Blofeld from the fucking James Bond movies, but other than that, it was supposed to be Vincent Price originally, which could have been something else. But again, I think it would have overpowered what else was going on in the movie.
Okay, I think I can get behind the bad good then.
Yeah.
That makes sense. But like, I would watch it again.
See, I feel differently.
You
feel
wouldn't watch it again?
No, I don't think I would watch it again. I feel like I would give it a bad good, and I give it a bad good because...
Well, then you would watch it again.
Well, is that part of the rating? Because I feel like I enjoyed it, but I didn't enjoy it to the point where I would be like, totally need to see this again. I want to show people, like, it's one of those films. I
to think give it a good rating for watchability is one of the criteria.
Watchable, but I wouldn't watch it twice. That's fair, right?
Well, like, in what... I think you think it's bad, bad.
I think it's maybe bad in your perspective, or maybe a soft bad good.
Would you watch it again next year?
Sure.
Okay, Halloween, so it's like the...
And no one had seen it, I would watch it again.
She's just not going to double up in a weekend.
More bad good, I think.
Can I go with a soft bad good? Like, I really appreciated the music and Tim Curry. That's the only really thing that kept me going. I think, personally, I'm just not into camp.
Sure.
And so... But I was so, like... I haven't watched a lot of Tim Curry besides It, which I'd seen a couple years ago. So I feel like... This, I was, like, so impressed with his performance. And I was like, oh, my God, wait, he, like, sings, and he's really good, and he's, like, totally going all in on this role where I'm, like, totally convinced. And, like, I enjoyed watching him, but the scenes without him, I wasn't that into. I lost interest towards the end.
So the end was a little slow.
It's a soft, bad good.
I love that modifier.
It's a coward's way.
But I'm going to give Tim Curry a good good.
Yeah, he is, yes. If we're going character by character, yes.
So before we go to Legend of 1985, Tim Curry is in another iconically campy cult movie in 1985, where he is Wadsworth the Butler in Clue. I know we got a couple Clue fans on the line here. What does this character and Tim Curry performance mean to you guys?
I love a house movie. This was Knives Out circa 1985.
Holy shit. You really staked in this territory.
That's high praise.
It.
Okay, that was high praise. But no, he was like charming and fun. And that was just like another like quick one that kept my attention. Maybe it was also the case that we watched it first. So like I was on
this
one of
true.
Four
this
movies.
Very, yeah, it's Mary and Lucy. Yeah,
and you got to like get me at the beginning.
She lost it movie two, I'm sure.
Clue's kind of the ultimate house movie.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm saying. I love a house movie. I love, like, the hidden corridors and, like, seeing what the set can, like, do for the plot, which is literally what this was about. There were, like, so many options.
By now, she was dead. We laid her down with our backs to the freezer. One of us slipped through the same secret passage.
Again?
Of course, back to the study. The murderer was in the secret passage. Meanwhile, Mr. Body beat on the floor. He jumped up. The murderer came out of the secret panel, picked up the candlestick. Mr. Body pulled this out of the study into the hall looking for an escape. The murderer crept up behind him and killed him. Will you stop that?
No.
I really love Clue, and I don't love that people don't love Clue. It's got some pretty negative ratings. It's just such a fun, campy, like, if you're going to make a board game movie, make it with the level of silliness that this one has. I think it has its flaws, and it's definitely dated in, you know, like, the gay panic and the blatant sexism. But, you know, other than that, I think it's pretty amusing.
Panic is so aggressive. Mm-hmm.
The three endings were really mind-blowing as a kid.
Were they?
Oh, I didn't know you could do that in a movie.
Oh. Mm. Should you?
I preferred it to just have one. I felt like I was like, let's wrap it up. I was ready to move on.
I think two options is acceptable. And like, of course, you need to have three to keep it odd. But like, Tim Curry like running frantically by the third ending was a little like I was out of breath.
Can we say, is there an argument to be made that it feels a little bit lazy to include more than one ending?
Yeah, it like doesn't have an ending.
Like, is that too bold to say? But that's kind of how I feel.
Can you criticize a 94-minute movie for really only having 70 minutes and then three different endings?
Yeah, I don't know. It's interesting.
Chance doesn't love Clue.
I've never loved Clue. I didn't love it when we watched it on the Movies About Games episode we did with Tag and Game Night a couple years ago. I think Tim Curry is, again, the best part of it because he's sort of like trying to win some sort of award for like best tour guide.
Most actor.
Yeah. So I'll somersault into the kitchen and I'll do a 360 like spin out into the study.
Tim Curry's just like so extra that he's like so hard to not watch.
Mm-hmm. Right. He snaps to attention like 200 times. Am I remembering that right? He definitely like straightens up and clicks his heels a few.
Mm. Oh yeah,
to really make a point.
Can I sprinkle in my TC fun facts for you?
Hit us with it, Lucy.
This is Tim Curry's favorite movie. And by the end, because the endings were so frantic and he had to do so much running when they were filming them, he actually had to be put on high blood pressure medication.
Oh, let it be known. Oh my God!
Wow.
Wow.
I'm just full of them.
I hope it was worth it.
You're crushing it in the TC Fun Facts corner.
Thank
you for bringing this.
That's all I've got. You're welcome.
It's almost like having him here on the program.
But Clue was fun. I'm into Clue. Mm-hmm. And now I will pass it off to you three to talk about Legend.
All right. Lucy fell asleep.
So Legend is one of those movies where, like, had I heard of this movie? Maybe, sort of. But then you look at it and it's like, oh, there's a Tom Cruise movie that I maybe don't know, and then it starts, and you're like, "This is a Ridley Scott and Tom Cruise movie." I maybe don't know.
It's such a red flag considering like how A-list this movie is that I had never heard of it.
Yeah, it's like a couple years after Blade Runner and 1 year before Top Gun. Like, how did this slip through the cracks? Doesn't bode well.
It was definitely like a stutter step towards much better things.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. No, you want
to
synopsize
Legend? I'm so glad to hear. Yeah. I'm so glad to hear that you're critical off the bat, Chance, because I was worried afterwards. Because sometimes we watch these movies and I go, this movie doesn't make any sense, dot, dot, dot. I bet Chance loves it. So this one is, a young man must stop the Lord of Darkness, Tim Curry, from destroying daylight, quite literally, and marrying a woman he loves, he being the young man.
Jack.
Jack.
Yeah, though there is that monologue where the Lord of Darkness seems that he also loves Mia Sara.
Oh, yeah. This is the one that made me think about, because he's like a devil. He's like Hellboy with the horns still on. It's like a big part of Tim Curry's screen presence is a level of seduction.
He's very sexy. He's like the sexiest guy with two antlers sticking out of his head you've ever seen.
Yeah, so this movie, I watched it at like 1 in the morning last night, and...
Oh, God!
By the end...
You poor bastard.
I really thought I was still 100% sober, by the way. And I thought I was, like, dreaming by the time it was ending. Like, where they're throwing around the shields to make the prism, like, am I still awake? Like, what is happening in this movie? You guys watched it in the cold light of day, it sounded like.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah, it was a midday affair.
Something really special that I've been promising to show you. Always go now, because I'll only be here for a short while.
Don't you trust me?
Trust you, Lily. Nothing is more magical. As long as they roam the earth, evil can never harm the pure of heart.
The bones of it are incredibly simple. It's just like a bunch of the simplest fantasy cliches. There's like a dark necromancer who wants to trap a unicorn using an innocent princess, and then there's like a hermetic hero who needs to be called to action, and there's like some elf helpers, and then they go fight the Dark Lord. Like, it's not...
like a little less fantasy and a little bit more like fairy tale, if we're being honest, especially in its movements from moment to moment and place to place. It's like flipping a sort of semi-illustrated page, and I mean, you gotta know something is amiss too. Second red flag with this movie is the 2,500 word prologue that like scrolls up the screen for 15 minutes before that thing then unfolds in front of you. It was very bizarre to have that kind of like reading obligation up front. Like, you don't want to have people scream like Breed it, oh, I'm going to get my glasses, right. Like, as you're into this movie.
That was so good.
But wait, no, it's funny you say that, because I have a little bit of trivia. I'm going to beat Lucy to it, where I read that Ridley Scott really tried to make it more of a fairy tale, and that he was taking things from Disney, such as Sleeping Beauty, Snow White, and as I'm watching it, I can totally see that, and especially with the prologue. They're bringing in the word, they're bringing in that like almost like once upon a time type deal where they're setting up the story for you.
Did it work?
Oof. No, I texted you last night. This is like the movie Willow, if you're on mescaline and someone tells you that God is dead. that's what this puppy is like, because the scenes go on, like a very simple scene of Jack being like, princess, this is a unicorn, that goes on for like 8 minutes of them like in a ravine looking at a horse with a stick glued to its head, and considering,
do you remember when the stick broke and they hot glued it back and then the unicorn came back to life? That's
the
only
unicorn
piece
wasn't
I watched.
Dead. Spoiler, the unicorn's not dead at all.
Oh, it's God, sorry.
Absolutely crazy how good like the makeup effects are in this movie, and yet like you can tell that it's like a piece of plastic that's like taped to a horse. It looks just terrible, considering that the Tim Curry makeup should have won an Oscar.
I mean, we know where the budget went.
Real
sure.
horses. Yeah. At least.
I think, though, that this movie, like, it does have some really cool production design. It also just has some, like, excessive set design. That's the problem with this movie, is that, like, it sort of trades in excess without really having, like, a beating heart to it. Because, like, the Mia Sara, Tom Cruise relationship is not that sparky. And they don't really have any chemistry. It was funny, Bree exclaimed when we were watching it that, like, when she does end up with Tim Curry, it almost, like, makes more sense. They seem to have more of a rapport.
I was rooting for them. I wanted them to make it work. I was like, honestly, go into the darkness, because I don't really know what the other guys got to offer.
That's a great point.
Absolutely. It did seem like they were more on each other's page in terms of, like, long-term expectations.
Yeah. I would much rather her go evil and have an interesting character arc than just be naive and young forever.
So that's, yeah. And that becomes the most interesting part of, like, the scenes mm-hmm. Tim Curry's in. But this world only really has... There's two acts, basically. There's the first act that is in the forest, and then there's the second act, which is just, like, underneath the forest, ?
Yeah.
And you're, like, suddenly inside, and there's fire everywhere, and it's not quite clear, like, how you transcended these two planes. And then we're fighting the devil, but he's also seemingly very mortal in a lot of ways.
The good parts of this movie have nothing to do with the story. I agree. I think that the sort of ballet seduction scene where Mia Sara dances with the faceless kind of count is really breathtaking in a weird, like, cologne commercial kind of way. And this is, like, Ridley...
It's funny you say that, because that's what Ridley Scott did, his project between this and Blade Runner.
And hadn't he just done the 1984 Mac commercial, too?
Oh, yeah.
Like, you really...
It's all just...
You feel that it's so sleek and so expensive looking. And, like, Ridley Scott's never made a movie that was bad looking. You compared this to Spawn earlier, Noah, which, like, that's a movie that looks like it's the inside of a Windows, like, 98 gateway. Like, this movie looks expensive and is kind of arresting at some point. But can we talk Cruise?
It's, can we? Yes. You know what this movie needs so much more of is Cruise running places. Yeah. Like, there's a lot of him ducking down and, like, looking around corners, but there is, like, not enough of him in a dead sprint. A
lot of Gollum squats.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. His poor knees, honestly.
He's young. He was fine. Did either of you feel like when he shows up, and he is, like, on all fours, and he's, like, not saying anything. Did you have a moment where you're like, is Tom Cruise going to talk in this movie?
I hoped for a second that maybe it was, a mute performance from him that we've just never heard about.
Yeah.
I mean, in the end, did he ever say anything actually important? Like, it could have been mute, honestly.
Right.
I don't really know what he said.
Well, I think...
I love you.
Mm-hmm. Brie, I think you're forgetting the iconic line, why is it like this? Why is it winter?
Where would we be without that line?
That was a question that I also had early on with this film. Why, after the first unicorn lost its horn, why was it winter? You know, it's like the reverse Punxsutawney Phil. It's like, if the unicorn loses its horn, that means 6 more weeks of winter.
Cruise is real. I went from howling at every single thing he said to basically forgetting he was in the movie, because mm-hmm. like, it just makes him run around with, like, little, like, elves, and there's nothing Cruisian about it at all.
No.
And there's that, what's the deal with the fairy who's, like,
no,
she's, like, upset a lot of the time, and it's unclear
ask.
Why her feelings get hurt early on.
Well,
I was unclear
because I think Tom Cruise didn't want her, maybe. We didn't really know.
How about some Tim Curry
again? Like,
best
it's
part
his
it.
Like
best part. I was telling Noah and Lucy, I said the way he enunciates his T's, there's just something about it.
Okay, this podcast is actually about Tim Curry's mouth.
Yes.
That's all that this is about. It's just
his
mouth
movement, the way he speaks, the way he enunciates. I mean, I could watch him in that devil costume all day.
But it's still, I mean, he's under 200 pounds of prosthetics,
yes.
But you're so right. It's still his lips and his teeth.
Yes.
I'm so engrossed, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Oh, his teeth are good.
Yeah.
His teeth are good.
Even with the bangs.
Yeah, the costume's unbelievable. It sort of looks like, I was texting you about this, Chance, it sort of looks like, you know, he's some sort of, it's almost like Space Jam or something, where he like represents like the 90s Chicago Bulls or something, with this kind of Dennis Rodman look to him. Sure. Which is so, it's so evocative, and it's hard to look away, but he's terrifying, and he's got these horns and then like the little ears that come even at, like underneath the horns. There's so much just coming out of him. This chin. Oh, it's whatever the sharper version of Bulbous is.
He does seem like the one who probably convinced Jerry Krause not to extend Phil Jackson's contract.
Yeah, that's it.
There's a little.
That's what he felt like, a character from The Last Dance.
Yeah.
Some simple conversation.
I have nothing to talk about. You've stolen my dreams away.
All things change, Lydia. The dreams of youth are the regrets of maturity. Dreams are my speciality. Through dreams, I influence mankind. My dream is of eternity with you.
Okay, like a little Monday morning quarterbacking on the Lord of Darkness, though. If you are he... Which are ye? Sorry. If you were he, would you have called out the thing about light destroying you, like, for the whole room to hear?
If you're really like planning this evil scheme that does require poaching of two specific animals, and then the only thing that can trip you up is sunlight. I don't know if I'd advertise.
Right.
But then, of course, I love the thing with the lights on the plates. It's like that scene in The Mummy when they like light up the Death City.
Love it. Bree, to your point about the teas, my favorite Curry line in this movie, which is sort of like unexpectedly deep, is when he says, dreams of youth are the regrets of maturity.
Yes, the T's. That was probably the line that did it for me. Like, he pronounced every single T in that sentence, and I was just like, oh, he's so right. Yes, I will marry you. End of story.
He is up
into
the
darkness
stage.
I go. Into the darkness. Yeah.
So I'm sorry, you were attracted to Tim Curry in this role?
No, I wouldn't say attracted, but I would say I'm attracted to what he offers.
This being the Dark Lord.
Bad Boys like to have more fun.
I don't
fun.
Know. I just, Tom Cruise was such a dud for me, and I think I would almost rather have darkness than lightness. That's just me.
Yes, he's like the guy on a motorcycle, like compared to...
Those are Lucy's words, not mine. But
I mean, he's just like more intriguing.
Yeah, I
think
he offers
a much
more
any like dark character.
Life.
Sarah didn't have a lot going on. She just wanted to touch things that were shiny.
She would have had more had she said yes. I will that's how I feel.
Right, the Lord of Darkness really would have like opened up her view of the world.
Maybe.
Fantastic. What are we rating Legend?
I don't mean to be hyperbolic, Chance, but I think this is maybe the worst movie we've watched for the podcast.
Wow. That's stupid.
Really?
Noah, you brought up Spawn earlier. Spawn is so much worse than this movie.
At least Spawn has like that kind of underdog spirit going for it, that you can tell it's like an independent film that could never be the thing that like they wanted it to be. Whereas this one's like, it seems like they put a script around these effects they wanted to do.
I would like to call out some movies we reviewed that are clearly worse than this one. including but not limited to The Saint, which is worse than this.
The Saint has a certain watchability to it, especially if the context is you, me, and your sister on like a conference call.
The Al Pacino film Hangman is much worse than this.
Okay, I'll give you that Hangman's... But this one's just such a disaster.
Monster
it's just
in
like
law.
Hangman knew that it was like streaming content. Like this is a big budget A-list movie that went totally off the rails.
And that's what makes it almost watchable. You know, I'm going to like Michael Keaton in 1989 Batman. I'm prepared to get fucking nuts about this. I think this is a bad good movie. It is a phantasmagoria.
Chance, you weren't even awake. Come on.
Are you really giving this a bad good?
That's absurd.
No, I would never watch this again. It's a bad bad.
I think it's a unanimous bad bad.
Some great insanity.
Can I play devil's advocate? I don't know. Oh, yeah. I feel like because your first bad is for like production value, correct?
Technical quality.
I mean, the effects were I like Noah and I were talking about this earlier. The practical effects, that's what you called it.
Yes,
I much prefer that. So I would give that a good, and then I'm inclined to give it a good just because.
Whoa.
I know. I almost don't want to say that, but I just feel like out of the three that we watched, this was the most interesting to me.
Even though you didn't have like 150 hike photos to go through while you were watching this movie in the background, you would have like gone to another rental 20 minutes in.
No, you did not let me finish though. I would say for certain scenes because overall
Overall she was bored, she says.
I think you could make a compelling case that it's a good bad. That like it looks so good and so inventive, but it's takes forever to get through.
Because I'm all about like high fantasy getting its like big budget and getting it to do and getting like a great director and like having its moment. Where this obviously fell flat because no one has heard of it. But I don't know. Yeah, I think it was just because of what Princess Lily and the Darkness guy. I think that was what had it. I wish the whole thing was about them rather, even though it really didn't quite make sense. But
I have to argue not to like cut down Bree's take on this because I didn't really watch it. But just based on that argument, if it didn't really make sense, I feel like that's bad. Doesn't the plot probably need to make sense? Isn't that a piece that goes into the?
Okay, fine. Then I give it a good bad. But I did. I would rather watch this one again than the other two.
You can give it a soft good. Amazing. You can give it a soft.
If you had given this a good, I would have like mailed you my microphone and wandered into the woods.
I just want to create a little anarchy on this podcast. All right, let's throw a little like difference in here, you know?
Okay, 1990. It.
In 1960, seven preteen outcasts fight an evil demon who poses as a child-killing clown. 30 years later, they reunite to stop the demon once and for all when it returns to their hometown.
It's not just us. It's all the other kids, too. Who's gonna be next?
It kills kids, damn it!
You killed my brother George, you bastard!
Let's see you now.
Maybe it's the water.
The water? Maybe it's the sewer.
Hi, Georgie!
So let me ask you a big question. No, because you read this book a couple years ago. Bree, did you say you'd read it or seen both movies?
No, I haven't read it. I've just seen all of the movies.
Okay. This is a leading question, of course, so you can disagree with the premise if you want. Is there a good way to adapt this book?
Yes. I think if you gave this, you know, like the HBO miniseries treatment, and really got into the fun, like, detailed stories that each character, like, goes through and how their personal arc is like tied in with that thing they fear most. Cause that's the It Clowns thing. It like, it makes you see the thing you fear most. And I think with the remake, the theatrical ones that just came out a couple of years ago did smartly, at least in the first one, was really focusing on those childhood struggles and like why the characters were afraid of those specific things. So I think if you have like a whole episode or something to dedicate to that story, and then just really like the history of this town, because I think that, I mean, just like the house is so important in Rocky Horror and Clue, you know, for this one, the town itself needs to feel very both remote, but also big enough that these things can happen and people can just ignore it.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's a long way of saying there is a good way to do it, but I don't think, I mean, the two movies are basically the same. It's like nearly 4 hours for both of them to tell this story. And I think they both have good things about them and they both have not so good things about them.
Yeah. I was just struck by how cumulatively it's so kind of buffet style, where it's like, okay, I have to watch every child get scared once, and then I have to watch every adult get scared once. And you're just, that structure or lack thereof is so inherent to like incidental hits and misses of these mini set pieces that I think what you're saying makes sense. I think if you gave, say, every character a half hour and then did one that was just like about the history of the town, you could like throw it back. That makes more sense to me than just like 4 hours of 14 scare incidents.
Yes. And I think both properties make that mistake. But in defense of the movies and their adaptation, that's kind of how the book works too. I mean, he kind of works his way through, you know, here's how this character got scared. Okay, now we're in Eddie's story. Now we're in Bev's story. Like, this is how she gets scared. So that's kind of what it is.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But that plays out differently in a mini series or like dedicating specific episodes to character development than it does. And it reads differently too than it does when you are just like going one to the other and it like making the rounds twice.
That is what it feels like, making the rounds. I mean, this was the visual representation of it for 25 years. How does it compare to the blockbusting Andy Muschietti movies from the last couple years?
But yeah, for me, I guess I was surprised how not bad the 91 is. Like, I was expecting it to be much inferior to the new ones. But in many ways, I think there are things that are better about this one, up into including maybe the representation of the It Clown. Like, I really do like the Tim Curry, like grouchy old man who then pivots into horrible beast thing, you know, more than maybe I like, who's the new one?
Bill Skarsgård.
Yeah, his sort of, I'm a kid too, like, come play with me kind of clown.
Mm-hmm.
I found the more recent remake of the first movie more enjoyable because I thought the actors were better. Like, I remember just laughing out loud during that movie, and I remember being more, like, enjoying it more than I was scared of it. I feel like for the end, I felt like for part two, I felt like the same way about both of them, where it's like you just get to a point where watching adults battle a clown just isn't the same as watching kids do it. And it just, like, even going back to the adaptation questions, like, I think when you read about adults fighting a clown, it just works better than in a visual sense. It just, I think it's just, you get bored. It feels weird, especially when it becomes a spider. Like, it just doesn't land.
Yeah. With the final representation of the It monster. And then, yeah, whether it's Bill Hader and company, you know, 2 years ago now, or was it last year? What is time? or, you know, the John boy from the Waltons taking down this thing with his ponytail. It really just doesn't feel it's that scary, because it's
right.
Yeah, I mean, it's, I mean, we can talk about the ponytail for another 25 minutes.
Yeah, this may be being charitable, but like, there's a way in which the adult characters have been sort of anesthetized and become like amnesiac in certain ways, to the point in this the second half of the 1990 version where they like they cannot get to the climax. They keep eating and drinking and being like, I might go, and like nobody ever asks Mike why he called them back. Like, it takes an hour for Mike to explain why they're there. But I think there is some point that Stephen King is trying to make about the nature of trauma and how like these people cannot remember stuff enough to finish the movie. But it's such a slog to watch, I thought, the last 45 minutes of this.
I beg your pardon. Come on up, Richie. I got a balloon for you. Don't you want a balloon? What's the matter? One balloon, not enough.
Try it! Please!
I feel like Bill Skarsgård is like almost too talented sometimes as new Pennywise to even parse what he's doing with his face versus what is CGI. And certainly I think the new Pennywise is scarier because of what they can do with computers and the way that, you know, he moves so swiftly. But just like compare the iconic Georgie arm scene. It is, you know, more terrifying in some ways when a computer mouth like literally bites off his arm. But it's a different kind of fear when a guy is in the sewer who's like, I think the John Wayne Gacy comparison is like very pronounced, and he just like grabs you and an old man is just holding the kid. Like, that is terrifying in its own way.
Yeah, it sort of embodies the, you know, like there's the creepy old guy over there. And it's like, oh, well, he wouldn't do that, would he? And then seeing those moments of violence are realized are terrifying. And I do think that because it feels a little bit more realistic instead of, you know, like, yeah, Bill Skarsgård's eyeball rolling around or something as the balloon floats by. Yeah. It just feels a little bit more unexpected, maybe.
Yeah.
Isn't there something creepier, too, though, about the Tim Curry Pennywise in that, like, clowns, like, while they are sort of scary, it's not because they're meant to be scary. Like, clowns are supposed to be funny. And so there's something, like, intriguing about him and the way that he, like, puts on this act of both, like, manipulating these kids and, like, not horrifying them, but, like, being, like, a little campy and, like, funny creepy, but then, like, totally switching it and then being, like, horrifying versus, like, sounds like in the remake he's just scary.
It's a great point.
Yeah, well, I do like that dynamic that you're right, he's not trying to like have them scared at all times. He's also trying to like double up on that in making it not only are you frightened, but like I'm fucking with you, like I'm doing this to get a rise out of you the way a clown like is like ooh, to like get a rise out of somebody, except doing something horrible instead of doing something innocuous.
The jester component is like way stronger with Curry.
For sure.
Like every set piece of like, is that a clown in a grave just standing there and him being like, ah, like it's way more like circus behavior.
Yeah. I feel like too, even he pops more in the original, just because I feel like it's kind of like a muted film, but then he's so bright. So like even in that grave scene, it's just like, it's jarring to see. Whereas in the remake, I think I find it pretty colorful and he almost kind of like melts into it, which is has its own sense of fear because you don't see him right away. But yeah,
that's a great point. The visuals of this one have a way of making it made me feel like I was kind of losing it, like the characters are, because you're like, that guy is really there. Does nobody else see him?
Like he doesn't like fit.
In the scene with the balloons in the library when Richie comes back, I think is probably the best Pennywise scene in the movie for me, because there's just like people behind Pennywise like looking at travel books and shit, and like nobody notices like a man in the frame in the same like matting as everyone else, just throwing blood balloons.
And speaking of practical effects too, I think this movie has some incredible practical sequences, especially the one I'll note is the shower sequence.
Yes.
Where it's, which one is it? It's Eddie Kasprak, I think. He's in the shower because the coach has told him that he has to take a shower after going to gym. And like the pipes and the shower heads start like moving at him and spraying hot water at him. And then this hand comes out of the drain, and then like the Pennywise clown comes out, and the tiles sort of move out of the way for him as if they were sort of like a, I don't even know, an accordion or something. It's really visually quite interesting that they were able to pull that off without really the use of computers.
I mean, like the shower scene, like an old man popping up in the drain as fucking like phallic handles grow and grow and grow when he's been forced to be naked in the shower is just like inherently fucked up and suggestive in a way that like you're just not going to see in a $200 million Warner Brothers movie in 2016. And
right.
To say that's brave is a little weird, but it is. Are there any Losers Club performances, child or adult from 90 that we want to shout out? Who did people like?
Brie was praising Seth Green last night.
The only time he's ever been cast as tall.
Tall and having a deep voice.
Yeah, as tall as he's ever been.
Yeah, it's amazing. Like 5 years after that, they're like, you get Eddie roles now for the next 20 years.
Yeah. I think he just gave me the humor I was craving because I just found the remake so enjoyable.
I really liked Annette O'Toole. Who, for those keeping score at home, is married to Michael McKean and wrote the Kiss at the End of the Rainbow song in Mighty Wind.
That's funny.
So there's a weird Be Real callback. But yeah, I think she's really good in this sort of like weird, like 50s to 80s way where, you know, everyone's like sort of in love with her, but she's managing it all.
Yeah. Yeah, this movie really gets more into, and talking about like just sort of being brave for television, this movie gets into the physical abuse between her and her father and the man she's dating in a way that the new movies really doesn't. It's also interesting, too, I'll pull out my own factoid. This is the first TV movie in which a puddle of blood was featured. Previously, it was thought to be too gory to do that.
I was wondering if you think the kids ever, like, after receiving decades upon decades of torture from Pennywise, do you think they ever just, like, tired of blood splatter? They're like, Pennywise, we've seen that one before. A lot of your stuff is blood splatter, dude.
Yeah.
That's the whole thing, though. It's like, they can't get over him. They're not ever going to get over him.
Some of his gambits are a little bit more amusing than others and like more thought out. Like I have to say, you know, some of them are great. Like the shower sequence is incredible. This one also has a really good Chinese food restaurant sequence. But I have to say like the John Ritter yellow balloon that says turn back now isn't necessarily the most frightening of his trying to get them to not fight him again.
But that's attempts. Right after, right before getting... Kiss Me Fat Boy, which is great.
Oh yeah, Kiss Me Fat Boy.
He like lures them
in. He loves
in.
Calling him Fat Boy.
And that's the Curry thing. He's still like, I am going to seduce you.
Yes. It's with that mouth.
Yeah. This also, and I can't believe I didn't like think of this with Legend, but like this is the movie that cements like, oh, his like speaking baritone is a weapon. An acting weapon that like lands him in the realm of someone like a Vincent Price, where just the way, again, with the Skarsgård comparison, like Skarsgård's You'll Float Too sounds like, you know, Yoda with less gruff. And this is like, he is enraged by the time he says, and by, like when you down
float
here with
too.
Me, you'll float too. It's like a butcher from Queens throwing you out of his shop or something. We should probably save this for the end, but I'll just do it now. I'm also thinking of like other things I've seen Tim Curry in, and they all like his part in Congo, which is a terrible movie. The most memorable thing he does in that movie is like eat a bunch of sesame cakes and fill his cheeks so full and then like spit it out when Delroy Lindo is like, stop eating my sesame cake. And then he like spits a bunch of like bread out. And it's just like, how big is this guy's fucking mouth? And then the first time I ever saw Tim Curry was in a episode of USA's Monk, where he played this like maniacal character named Dale the Whale Biterbeck. And it was also just like eating and spitting and like, yeah, the mouth is the thing with him.
He's a mouth actor. There's a few of those right out yeah there. He is one.
Well, his
yeah
iconic moment from Home Alone 2 is also like his ability to do the Grinch smile at the concierge holy desk shit at the Plaza Hotel. Like all of our memories of him as an actor are mouth related.
That's amazing. Good pull.
I would argue that like mouth actors, and I'm thinking specifically like Kerry Washington.
Don't get me started.
She's like a distracting mouth actress, and she is like hard.
My blood is boiling.
She's hard to watch sometimes, but
extremely
like
hard to watch.
Every Tim Curry like mouth performance, it's not like a. Yeah. It's not off-putting.
Well, he's a good mouth actor, and she is a bad mouth actor.
Okay, that's maybe the situation here, but like. Yeah,
she wishes she was a mouth actor.
That
too much. Sorry. Too much.
You heard it here first, folks. Kerry Washington, bad mouth actor.
I didn't know that he was the voice of Nigel Thornberry, which
Eliza.
Yes, I knew no one thought I was going to do it.
Eliza, we heard. Lord Nelson's trousers, it's a yeti. No creature threatens a Thornberry.
I'm going to give it a good bad, because I think there are interesting things about it. There are like things about its limitations that I think force it to be more interesting, not limited to also just the fact that it's like shot in a creepy old town in a creepy old sewer system, like on a weird lily pad reservoir, which is... forever sort of more eerie than, again, having $200 million to design such a thing. And Tim Curry's great, and I think it's probably a good bad. I don't think I'm going to pop this one on again anytime soon, but like very happy to have seen it.
I think I'm going to disagree. I really do like the It property, and I'll sort of cop to that. But I think this one's good. You know, I think it's good in ways that the new one isn't, in that the effects feel a little bit more practical and a little bit more fun to deconstruct. I mean, some of them are like, I mean, it's not quite like American Werewolf in London or whatever, but it's some really cool gross things that happen in a way that I guess is safe for TV at this time. So I see what you're saying about the limits of it. But I don't know. I really found this one pretty charming, and it is kind of a, you know, this construct of 90s TV too, with John Ritter, you know, with Richard Thomas in it as well. And then, yeah, Tim Curry's performance, like you're kind of waiting to, of course, as the movie goes, you're waiting to see Pennywise again. But as the viewer goes through, I feel like I was waiting to see Tim Curry again. And that was enough to pull me through. Good.
I think I have to agree with that. At least like giving it a soft good. I feel like this one's like a movie that if you were to watch it again, like next year, because it's 4.5 hours long. You do get something.
307.
Okay, fine. you do like, I think you get something, you'll probably get something new from it. I feel like there's, you know, it brings up some interesting conversations. I do think that it was fun and like creepy. And like if you have a snack break in between, definitely manageable in an afternoon.
Okay.
How do you feel?
I think I'm going to go and agree with Chance on this one. I'm going to give it a good bad. I just feel that, I feel like the way the film was structured when they were doing like the parallel scenes of like young and old, that just didn't really grab my attention as much. I just felt like I never really got a chance to learn each I don't want to say character because it's the same character, but like young and old, I just didn't really get a chance that I really got to know them. And it did just feel like long at some point and a tad bit slow for me. Maybe not enough scares.
You wanted to be more scared?
Yeah, maybe a little more scared because they're just, you can just tell how traumatic it is and how terrified they are. And
so it's like hard to get behind their reactions if you don't like feel that.
It, like their trauma like makes me believe it, but I was never really scared in the movie. And I think maybe that just goes, it needs to be a longer miniseries because I need to really get to the reasoning behind the scares.
Okay.
We did it.
We did it. Any more? Do we have any more TC fun facts? Are we out? Is the cover
I think I'm out of TC fun facts, but let me say all that right. Tim Curry has been a welcomed guest at this Vermont cabin.
I did not quite know. And now I know.
No,
he is good. Good mouth actor. Would watch another film with him.
Well, let's do another TCFF, a Tim Curry fond farewell. This has been very fun, you guys. No.
Fun fact works too.
Enjoy the rest of your weekend, and please don't go into any sewers up there.
I've been telling Noah all weekend. I have Final Girl vibes for sure.
Lucy and my hubris will definitely take us down early on.
Absolutely.
We're prologue murders at best.
Bri, as the lone survivor, will you send me the audio, please?
I will. Absolutely. All right, thank you. Got it.
Well, this was fun, guys. Happy Halloween, everyone. And
ooh, happy Halloween.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. Don't get strung out by the way I look. Don't judge a book by its cover. I'm not much of a man by the light of day, but by night I'm one hell of a lover.